and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're joined by stand-up comic extraordinaire and Whose Line Is It Anyway star, Greg Proops.
Good evening. I'm the Proclaimers. Nice to be here in Eberg in Scotchland. I've got to be speaking Esperanto when I get into the cabs, because the cab drivers don't understand a word that I say, man. Every night I get into the cab after my show. Last night I ended up in Aberdeen, you guys. I must sound like this to them. Yeah, 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 yeah. Damn it. Yeah, 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 yeah. Turn here. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wrong way, dude. Because this is what they sound like to me. You specky git.
Our guest tonight is one of the busiest men in show business, comedian Greg Proops. You've seen him in sitcoms and heard him in voiceovers. He's hosted a television dating game, a comedy game show, and he tours with the Improv All-Stars. He has regularly appeared on both the British and American versions of the hit TV show hosted by Drew Carey in the U.S., Whose Line Is It Anyway? But Proops has always considered stand-up his real job, his calling. Raised in the San Francisco Bay Area, Greg Proops made his first awkward appearance on a local stage at the age of 15. Now 43, Proops performs on both sides of the Atlantic. He has a devoted following in the UK. He's performed recently for troops in Bosnia, Kosovo, and the Persian Gulf. Proops' comedy is smart, fast, and irreverent in the tradition of Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, and his own personal hero, Bill Hicks. He describes his style as a sort of Baroque dissing, a lot of adjectives punctuated with profanity, calling on the carpet everything from Hollywood life to weapons of mass destruction to the Osbournes. Tonight, the stand-up life and the world according to Greg Proops. Greg Proops, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
It's great to have you here. You perform on both sides of the Atlantic and a lot. We know you have a huge following in the UK. We have to dive in somewhere. Let's dive in there. What's the difference in the audiences and in the humor that works here, works there?
Well, it's more of a cult following, really.
And when you're too modest.
Yeah. When I mean cult, I mean I'm their bizarre leader and they do my bidding. I think it's a matter of timing more than anything, believe it or not. American audiences are timed one way. We get to the punchline. We go set up punchline and then tag, tag, tag. And as you're tagging the joke with extra jokes, an American audience will laugh over them. This is not something that audiences are conscious of. Because it's technical comedy stuff. And then you go to England and you go set up punchline and you start to do the tag and they stop because they want to hear that. That's another joke.
So you don't have that mounting kind of Las Vegas wave of laughter that we always hear in the movies or when we're there.
Yeah, no, it's true. It doesn't stop and start as much as it's a different kind of role. And that took me a long time to get used to.
What about on the dark side, the nervy side, the satiric, cynical side? The reputation is that they hugely outweigh the American in appetite for that.
I would have to agree in some respects. I mean, obviously, I tend to be snide and sarcastic, and that requires a certain amount of mental gymnastics to get. If you are a person who lives in an unironic world, then you will not recognize irony necessarily right away. The English, by their very nature, because they're pessimistic, and they communicate with sarcasm. One another on a personal basis.
Minute by minute.
Oh, yeah. As you well know, you've known many Scottish and English people. And
it happens we have.
They don't necessarily communicate the same way Americans do. When other Europeans move to England, what they're surprised by is that everyone makes fun of everyone all the time. And what's going on here?
Right.
How come they make fun?
You know, vicious.
Right. People come from Spain or Norway and are like, all they do is make fun
Uppsala.
Of me. Yeah, right. And so my natural snideness, I'm optimistic there. I'm Pollyanna in England. Here I'm considered dark and cynical, if you want to use the whole word.
Rewind the tape. We would just want to use cynic.
Yeah, I'm considered dark and cynic in the singular. And there I'm perky and peppy. Mm-hmm. So there is, I think, a little more edge there.
Greg Proops, you are really working the waterfront and have been for a long time. I don't know what kind of drugs you're on or what your metabolism is, but the dosage is set high either way. It'd be great if you just walk us through some of that with some impressions of these different things. And the one that you may be known most widely for in the U.S. is Whose Line Is It Anyway? The Drew Carey thing. You've been on there very often with your Buddy Holly, famous Buddy Holly glasses, specky guy.
Yeah.
And I have watched people watch that show, including with you on it, and just fall down in laughter at how crazy, how wonderfully improv can unfold and how quickly. Is it a natural home for you?
Yeah, I really have. I've loved doing it because One, I learned to do improv in college from all my buddies. I there was an improv. You're not asking me this question, but I'm going to take a circuitously long answer.
Oh, fine.
When I was a teenager, I was first at school at San Francisco State, which is a tremendous academic school.
But you were brainy. You were on some kind of college bowl, Mr.
Man, you know everything.
Yeah,
right?
Yes,
I did.
Everything.
I played on the college bowl team, and I was the captain. Mm. Our listeners of Vintage Age will remember the television version of College Bowl.
The television virgin. I loved her. She was
She was a tremendous. Very popular. Well, actually, not that popular. That's why she remained a virgin of College Bowl for so long.
Sorry.
And then some of the younger listeners may not quite remember it, but it was a real game show because they asked real questions.
Real hard questions.
Real hard questions. Like, all of a sudden, you have to know the periodic table of elements, and you have to know, you know, James Joyce's oeuvre. Now, I didn't know these things, but there were people on my team who did,
Well, but you were captain, and somehow but the line from there to Drew Carey, you were improvising.
Yeah, and the funnest part of me for the College Bowl was, of course, stalling the other team out when we got the lead and playing sports tactics, which they really hated because they were a lot of academics. And we would answer and go, I don't know, and they'd get really angry. But so I learned from the other kids at school how to do improv, and then got on Whose Line 1989. Of course, I was 11. And the funnest part has been watching. Of course, Colin and Ryan are like geniuses of improv, and I've worked with them for 14 years now or whatever. And what
though they acknowledge that you are the best, we read.
I'm tired of dragging them, quite frankly.
They're
dead weight in my life.
Yeah, yes, we can see that.
It's like filling water jugs and just dragging them up the hill. It's a lot of effort for not a lot of payoff because they don't have that much personality at the end of the day, not like I do.
But how do you all do it? Do you drink like 6 cups of coffee then go out, or do you have an improv groove that you get into? What's the kind of mental mechanism? Do you have to be a genius or just gutsy enough to let it spill out?
That's a very good question. I think the most important thing is to not think too much. I know that sounds insipid, but there's a certain amount of engaging your intellect and also disengaging it, because as soon as you engage it, you're going to be critical. And when you're critical, you're analytical, and then you start...
The filters go up, and
exactly.
Pretty soon nothing to say.
Exactly. And when you don't
censor, where most of us live most of the time.
Pretty much. I hate to use the word, it's like jazz, because it's completely overused in a comedic sense all the time, but it is like jazz in that it's riffing. And when you're blowing as hard as you can, you're not thinking about what you're going to say next. It's simply coming out, and those are always the funniest things that are reactive.
Let me ask you this about Drew Carey. He's a very funny guy, but I have read you...
He's not that funny.
Well, okay, he's not that funny, but he has some reputation for occasional humor.
Yeah.
But you have written, forgive me, but insightfully about Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, Bill Hicks. I mean, these were tough, you know, butt-kicking guys who really shook your sense of what was going on in the world. Drew Carey seems to hew, where's he from, Cincinnati? I don't know, Ohio,
Cleveland. Yeah.
I mean, he always wants to be Mr. Cleveland. He doesn't, to my ear, shake it up. Am I missing something? And if he doesn't, is he worthy?
Very good question. Obviously, he's a good friend of mine because he's been so very kind, and he is a true mensch. And what you see is what you get with Drew. He really is a blue-collar. He likes to drink Budweiser beer. He was in the Marine Reserve. He's a Maxim magazine kind of guy. There is no question about that. His comedy, no, is not edgy like Bill Hicks or Lenny Bruce or Pryor. And those are the comics that I, of course, deem the most worthy, and I aspire to breathe their air. I don't aspire to be them because you require a Christ complex and some massive self-hatred, but you and of
just
course
for a start.
A self-destructive streak and a huge drug addiction, but other than those things, and I'm working on those, other than that, I think Drew's worthy in that what he has is something, Tom, that you and I couldn't manufacture with all of our, you know, cleverness and work and all that. People love him.
Yes, they do.
When he comes into a room, they light up. In TV, there's a horrible measure of people's popularity called the Q.
Yeah.
And it's the factor whereby networks measure how popular people are.
It's just kind of animal appeal of some kind.
It's exactly that. It's just magnetism. And like maybe Kelsey Grammer, who's quite popular and very funny and extremely erudite, doesn't have the cue that Drew Carey does.
We're going to come back to the greats here. Maybe Drew will come up in that context again, but I want to keep rolling out these career elements of yours because there's so many, and it's kind of more than amusing in and of themselves. Let's see. Versus. I just love this. This is the game show where you pit natural enemies or groups of people one against the other. What was it on?
One Glorious Season on Comedy Central.
Okay. Soccer moms versus dominatrixes, female bikers versus male nurses, goth chicks versus beauty queens, bodyguards versus paparazzi. your idea, or did they draft you to this role as host?
They did, and it was fantastic. The producers are good buddies of mine, and I didn't know them at the time. They called me in, and there was no meetings, and that's what sold me. We never met once. They said, this is the idea. They didn't even show me a tape. This is the idea. Do you want to host it? And I said, yes. And then we never had a meeting after that. While we were making the show, we never had a meeting.
They set up the groups for you? They just fed them to you? I mean, they're hilarious.
My favorite was Santas versus Witches, because the witches were fantastic. And the final question was the Big Witches Holiday, which is, I believe, Beltane.
Okay. I wouldn't know, but now I do.
Yeah, and they did, and they nailed it.
And how about Santa? Did they nail him? I mean, did Santa have a chance?
Santas were, they were, you know, they were what you would expect. They were like department store Santa guys. They were kind of part-time Santas, and they didn't quite know the Santa. They knew their Santa lore. The people who were the worst and most horrible were, we had Beverly Hills versus Compton, and the Beverly Hills people were insufferable prigs.
They were just prigs,
period. They thought because they had nice cars, they were good people. It was so mortifying.
That's 90210 versus 90220.
Yeah.
I wonder about the line on cable. I mean, Sex and the City and all the stuff out there. People say, oh, cable, anything goes. You played around on the show. You know, you had soccer moms and dominatrixes. Down on your knees, you van-driving slut, you said. But where is the line in cable? You must go on every stage with some sense of where the boundaries are, or maybe you don't. But is cable free?
Freer.
We all pay through the nose for it, but you know what I mean.
Yes. Freer in the sense that, especially Comedy Central, which, believe it or not, even for a giant monolithic owned corporation, if you're going to swear, they'll let you swear, and then they'll just beep it later, rather than making it an issue and go, take out all the swearing before you begin. And there's a certain amount of freedom in that. And I know a lot of people would argue, you know, the Marx Brothers never sweared and they were funny. Yeah, well, the Pope doesn't swear and he's not funny, okay? So it's part of the vernacular, as I think Mencken or even Mark Twain might agree. If it was in common coin in those days, they would have used it as well.
Greg Proops, we love the way you respond to what's going on in the world. And there's a lot going on. I'm just looking here at the front page of the New York Times. Just wonder what thoughts you have.
The New York Times, the paper that always prints the truth.
Yeah, always the truth. But here, this one seems fairly irrefutable. Justices 6-3 legalize gay sexual conduct in sweeping reversal. Greg Proops.
I'm from San Francisco, and so this is going to be a huge decision where I come from. There have been people waiting in their closet for so long just to get the word from Sandra Day O'Connor that they can spring free and date. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you sit around waiting. I wonder what Tony Kennedy...
Nothing doing for year, decade after decade, just waiting on the
sitting quietly
court
with a candle, right, maybe some chocolates.
Not even an impulse.
No. God, I wonder what David Souter thinks about my lifestyle. Now I can go freely and do... I thought it was the fiery opinion, as the USA Today described it, of Antonin Scalia, that his anti-opinion, that this is sure to destroy the family. What shaky sexual identity Justice Scalia must have.
But it is interesting. It's put sodomy in the headlines for the first time in years.
Oh, I love that. Don't
imagine
you?
When.
Yeah. Sodomy has been left alone too long, in my opinion, Tom.
Well, it's had a thorough airing in the last day and a half. Same day, interestingly, Strom Thurmond. Dead at 100.
Yes. Apparently, Strom was a senator for so long, he voted against the Emancipation Proclamation.
Is that right?
And, yeah, he was there for that. Trent Lott got in some trouble earlier this year because he was at Strom's 100th birthday party and made some comment that if Strom had won the election in 1948 as a segregationist, that we wouldn't have all that trouble.
We remember well. Yeah. That's a picture, isn't it?
Yeah. You know,
President Thurmond, 1948, maybe two terms. Forget about Ike. Could have been a different story.
Yeah, really. It really could have. We could have lived in that dream society. Oh, wait a minute. We're living in it now. President.
Oh, there we are. We will be back with more of Greg Proops, and we're awfully glad you're here. We do hard work here night after night. You're helping us out. We need you, Greg Proops.
I'm hoping to be funny, Tom.
Tonight and every night. Well, okay. We're waiting for that. But let's go into a short break listening to him with fellow Whose Line Is It cast members performing an impromptu song on education. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
To college, I wasn't very smart. I throw my hands up, giving up at the very start. Every test I take, you know, you test it, would I fail? But it doesn't matter, cause I am Dan Quayle. I had to take an exam. I studied very hard. I thought up very, very hard and put things on a card. I studied, tried all my best, and then I went and realized it was a urine test. I love exams. They are so much fun. I love to take the paper and sit down on my bum. Oh, I am very smart. Oh, it might sound kind of silly, but I pass every test because I write notes right there in my willy. I hate examinations. It fills me with such fear. I get the collie wobbles and lots of diarrhea. So if you are a student, don't care about the pain. Get through your exam by taking lots of cocaine.
I'm Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with actor, improver, and stand-up comedian Greg Proops.
The Pilgrims were asked to leave England. England was never funner than when the Pilgrims split, right? The people of England got a little tired of these dour, right-wing, conservative psycho-Christians wearing all black, bumming people out, confusing everyone by wearing buckles on their heads. Is that tight enough for you, Cotton? Yea, verily. Finally, someone went, hey, I've got a crazy idea. Why don't you freaky little weirdos get in a rickety, leaky, dinky little boat and get the f*** off the island, huh? Sail around till you hit the New World. When you get there, commit genocide on the indigenous people, all right? Have a groovy time. Have a witch trial. Let us know how that works out for you. We'll be back in England having the Renaissance in case anyone needs us.
Greg Proops on the Pilgrims and America. We're delighted to have Greg Proops in the studio. We need you, Greg. There's almost too much news out there, but you set a very high bar, a very high standard, and I wonder how you possibly live up to it. You have said that as a comedian, of course you said this to some paper in Scotland, you're always over there in Scotland.
You can't get work here, Tom.
Yeah, only bundles. It's important to be, public radio, I don't know, pissed off. You say, I don't want to be complacent or even perceived as complacent or Bob Hope or easy way out. Now then, we turn on over to chapter 23 and we see Greg Proops. You were recently on a USO tour to Bosnia, Kosovo, and the Persian Gulf. It sounds kind of Bob Hope-y.
It was a little Bob Hope-y. I went with Drew, and Drew took us there because he is a thriving member of the USO. And I believe that it's important to separate two things. One, I don't support the war in any way, shape, or form, and I don't support Bush in any way, shape, or form. However, the troops are there to do a job, and they are well representing the underclass, as you might imagine. And I think you have to separate the job from the ideology, as it were. The troops don't make the decision to go to war. They are simply employed to do that. And believe it or not, this alleviates their day. They call their life Groundhog Day. And the fact that they have to wait for a couple of hours for our show, then we do the show, and then we meet everyone after, which is the best part. We meet everyone we play for. So you literally meet everyone in the audience, which you never do in the commercial world.
What kind of settings were you in? Is this like we see with Bob Hope, with a semi-trailer truck, the side falls down, there you are with dancing girls in a golf club?
Yeah, I was there with Jerry Colonna and Anne Jillian right here. Bring her out. Sometimes you're on a makeshift stage. Sometimes the mics didn't work. You find yourself in a variety of different, in an aircraft hangar, wherever mm-hmm. they put the show on. And the troops, you can't imagine how excited they are just to be there. Whether or not we get any laughs, it makes no difference at all because we've made them forget about their job, basically, for a couple of hours.
We know one of your big heroes, who you put up there in the Pantheon with Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor, is Bill Hicks. Not nearly as well known. Maybe you'll tell us a little bit about him. But he was one of the very few American comedians who was outspoken against the Persian Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Bill Hicks? What did he have to say about that war?
Bill Hicks was a comic who started when he was about 15 years old. He died at the age of 31, about 10 years ago. He had bad pancreatic cancer, very untimely demise. During the
Persian, Texan, right?
Yeah, he was from Texas, and he was initially part of that outlaw posse or whatever they always say of Carl LeBove and Sam Kinison and whatnot.
But raised very Baptist, right down in the church.
Oh, seriously. And his parents always were, so he knew quite a bit about religion and had quite a lot to say about it. He was fairly scabrous in that he said what he felt. I was quoting him today to someone else. He said, less jokes and more me. And I've always felt that that's true. The closer you get to your own personality and what you're going to say, the more what you say can be innately funny. And during the Persian War, the first Gulf War, Gulf War One, mm-hmm. the one where we really had a coalition of the willing, not just Herzegovina and
Micronesia.
Yeah. mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the UK.
Imagine how confident
and the Aussies.
That's true.
But in that first Gulf War.
The troops were so comforted this time knowing Portugal had their back. He was one of the few comics that actually spoke out against it. I didn't at the time. I didn't have the wherewithal, and I wasn't at that place yet, and I couldn't articulate it. And he used to do these hysterical routines about, if we have smart bombs, how come we don't have smart food? How come we can't launch a banana into a hungry person's mouth, but we can bomb poor people? That the Scud missiles were basically just old Buicks. That's how effective they were, and none of them went off. It was as if shooting a giant car into the air with a member of Hezbollah in it, you know. And he used to do a joke where he'd say, Bush has an approval rating of 95%. You know who that 5% that doesn't approve is? Me, and f***ing me.
There we go. Bill Hicks. And now we've got this new war.
Mm.
People thinking all kinds of things about it. I know that you've had a bit to say about weapons of mass destruction and America's little arsenal.
Well, ostensibly, the reason we fought Iraq in the war, or attacked them, was that they have weapons of mass destruction. Apparently, our weapons are weapons of growth and nurturing. And they've done a very good job, as you can see, hiding their weapons of mass destruction. How cleverly they've hidden them, almost as if they weren't there at all. Thank goodness we've had the poet laureate Donald Rumsfeld to explain things to us on a day-by-day basis. I think my favorite poem is, "We don't know what we don't know." Surely that will confound the terrorists. They must be sitting at home going, they don't even know what they don't know. Well, what do they know?
Can you believe a liar?
Yeah.
Well, how would you critique Donald Rumsfeld? I mean, you see improv all the time. He's improvising. I mean, he spent months at that podium.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that his values and mine don't match in any way. After the war was over, so to speak, after they announced it was over, one of the reporters said, how are we going to conduct the occupation of Iraq? And Donald Rumsfeld, in his usual genial snapping turtle way, went, can't we just enjoy the moment? And for me, you know, when you're enjoying the moment, that's when you're having a piece of pie with your family, maybe in the afterglow of some sort of sexual relations. That's when you enjoy the moment. Maybe a child's first step. That's when you enjoy the moment. After you've bombed a country into submission is not a time that I take out to enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Donald Rumsfeld and I diverge, as Robert Frost might have said.
Maybe just a little, I don't know about if they have yellow woods in Iraq or not. We'll find out. But it's tough zone. You've written wonderfully about these big comedians, about Lenny Bruce, who, as you write, brought us out of the comfort zone, about Richard Pryor, forced us to confront the elemental issues we like to pretend we have solved. Do you try to go to that same place?
I try to do what I can do and what I think is funny. I really don't think about...
Is that a cop-out?
Is that a cop on it? Wow, this is hard-hitting and biting. This is everything I expect from National Public Radio. One would hardly believe there's corporate funding.
You're smart. You're watching the world. You write beautifully about the wonder of these comics. And you're a working comedian. You're working everywhere. You're making jokes everywhere. Mm. I mean, do you think, I can't get out of bed today because I might make a joke that's not worthy? Or is that just not on these days? I don't know.
I'll tell you what I try to do, Tom. I try to be honest. I try to be honest with how I feel. And I try to not back down if the crowd disapproves. If I'm preaching to the unconverted and they're booing me and or walking out, I carry on doing what I do. And that's as far as I can tell you what I do. I can't be Lenny Bruce because no one can be Lenny Bruce.
Right.
And I can't be Bill Hicks because Bill Hicks had other issues.
So we look back at the Lenny Bruce 50s and we say, oh, wow. You know, I mean, in a way, it was a sitting target. Here was this big, fat, rich country with a layer of denial about, you know, 15 miles deep in the bunker. Look at all the targets he had. How different are things today, Greg Proops?
Oh, I think things are richly, richly peopled now with targets. I think the state of play in America, I think the general pall that's been cast over the country since W became selected, I think there's so many things to talk about now that we have almost exactly the same targets. Hypocrisy. If you don't think religion is an issue now, you haven't been reading the paper. And the government, I think we're in it. Sadly, I think we're in an intellectually stagnated time as far as the media and the government go. I wouldn't say that about people because I think people are always ahead of the curve.
Well, what does that mean, stagnated? The media is what, sycophantic? It's not doing its job?
The media
it's
are the scribes tank. For the government. They are lapdogs. They are secretaries. They write down what the government says, and that's what news is. And, of course, that isn't what news is. And I think if you went back to the generation before, like, for instance, David Brinkley, who just died, or Walter Cronkite, I think they would disagree utterly with having to parrot what the Defense Department says about certain issues and things like that.
Let's take up NPR then. Is it also in the tank there? Do you see NPR scribes? I don't know. Take off on NPR. Everybody who's listening here listens to NPR. Is NPR just too full of itself? When you sit back and put on your palm buzzer with NPR, what comes out?
I listen to NPR. I prefer Pacifica. It's a little more to the left of NPR.
Oh, so we've got you pegged on that.
Yeah, you do. I like NPR. It's a little Montessori school for me sometimes. I don't need to be talked down to. I'm very bright and I get it. And sometimes the sonorous tone reminds me of Canadian radio. And at a certain point, I want to kill myself. But I think by and large, NPR is on the side of the angels. I think during the war, NPR crumbled a little bit. And for good reason. You're getting money from people who supported the war, so you have to jump to your master's bidding. And I'm as guilty of it as anyone else. I'm not saying I'm not a prostitute as well. We all are in our
Saturday morning,
way.
War's on, Scott Simon's on the air. What do you hear in that tone?
Uh-huh. I'm not sure who Scott Simon is.
Saturday. Oh, you're out there listening to Pacifica. What is that?
You blew me out.
Out of Hanoi?
Yeah, you got me. You nailed me, buddy.
Well, maybe you may have a touch of monkeypox coming on in that case.
I do. I was just in Colorado, and I couldn't leave that little Auburn prairie dog alone. It was so cute. It winked at me and it was beguiling.
How close to a prairie dog do you have to get monkeypox?
I'm not sure. I think the law that the Supreme Court just upheld indicates the intimate congress with monkeypox-laden prairie dogs is probably ineffective. It's probably bad for your
Rick
health.
Rick Santorum. Now, listen, speaking of prairie dogs...
Now, mind you, Pacifica has its problems, too.
Well, no doubt. No, we shouldn't let NPR go just that quick, I guess.
I don't want to. I don't want everybody think I'm just slamming it, and it's an easy target, because, of course, it is. NPR, to me, smacks of white liberals. And the thing... I am a white liberal, so I'm not out of the ballpark here. But what gets me about white liberals is they feel that they know what's right for everyone else almost as much as arch-right-wing conservatives. Mm-hmm. And that's the part where I break off from that. White liberals tend to think that animals are important and that it's important to really like animals. And I think it's really important to like people more than it is to like animals. It's easy to like animals. Animals on a case-by-case basis. You know what I mean? Some animals are jerks.
One at
like
a
children.
Time.
Exactly.
Some are gerbils. If you put it up against the BBC, I mean, which you have done work for, so we know you're deep in their pocket. But compare the two.
They're both bound by the same political correctness mandate. The comedy documentaries that I do for the BBC, we often have to have a woman, a black person, a Jew. You know, we really do break
one
it down.
One of every kind,
oh, yes,
open Noah's Ark.
Because you see, the rainbow is how respect is built. And in a way, that's groovy, so I go with the flow on that one. During the war, I was in England for a lot of it, and the BBC crumbled like everyone else. They started with some principles, and then they fell by into, look at this magnificent scene. Here's the statue of Saddam Hussein is being pulled down by American troops in front of 50 paid extras. What a tremendous scene of democracy. You know, they fell into that, too.
So, all right. So given that, where do we get to a real conversation in this country then? Where do we get to a conversation? I mean, here you are. You're slamming George Bush. You don't like Donald Rumsfeld. You don't like the war. And in the other corner, you're saying, well, you've got the Montessori school going on. Yeah. Hey, listeners will come down on all sides of this. But do we have a really vigorous conversation going on here about the state of the union?
Well, you and I do. I don't think the country does anymore, and that's been the biggest disappointment to me. I don't have to have solutions because I'm a comedian.
No, you
that's
don't.
The easy
you don't.
Way
just,
out.
Just tear in there.
But I wish there was more conversation and a lot less of shut up, because that's what I hear on television. When you watch the giant entities like Fox News and MSNBC, which took a gigantic turn to the right during the war, and CNN and things like that, there is no other side presented. They say fair and balanced. It's not fair and balanced, because I guarantee you, I marched in San Francisco. There was 250,000 people in that march. I had friends who marched in New York. Mm-hmm. There was 750,000 people. Friends who marched in London. There was 1 million people in that anti-war march. None of those people are being represented necessarily on network television and or on cable news outlets. And if the argument is boiled down to this, you'll go, I'm for the president. And then the other person says, I want peace. And then the host says, shut up. And that's the whole argument. And that's where I get off the train. So I really feel like if we discuss things, we understand each other. And if we don't discuss things, then there's a lot of yelling and screaming and I hate you and why don't you join the Fedayeen and why
it's
don't
also
you?
Interesting. There's a way of discussing things that doesn't really get at anything.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? There's a bloodless way of endlessly gumming things that can't get... let's see, channel a little bit for us. Because you can. I mean, Lenny...
Richard Pryor, Bill Hicks, come to us now. You know, we're joining hands around the studio table. What would they have to say about what about the country?
I would say that they would think that there's a major lie being lived right now, that we're pretending that we're all united, one, and that we have a president who unites us, which is not necessarily true. I think they would
But how major is that? I mean, you're giving the lie to that right here. I mean, there's all kinds of people protesting. Are we really? Or is that the media sheen?
It's the media sheen. Okay. All right. I am as guilty as anyone else of being reading too many papers and watching too much TV.
Oh, no, it's good. Be informed.
And
Lenny, Richard, Bill, go on.
I think they would see a lot of hypocrisy in a president who quotes Jesus all the time and doesn't really live up to those principles. I think they might have something to say about, for instance, the man who they're calling the serial bomber, Eric Rudolph.
The Atlanta Plaza bombing, the guy who hid in the woods.
If he was not a white Christian male who the police and the people of North Carolina had hidden, he would have been called a terrorist. If his name was Ahmed, he would have been a terrorist. But he's a serial bomber, you see, according to the media.
Yeah.
People who blow up women's shelters and gay bars are heroes, and people who take scissors on a plane are terrorists. So there's a semantic issue in this country.
Oklahoma got the terrorism label laid on it.
Uh-huh. But why doesn't Eric Rudolph? And then people go, oh, he lived as a homeless person. Not with new clothes and a haircut, you don't live as a homeless person. I'm from Hollywood, and I know what homeless people look like.
Yeah. You know what new clothes and a haircut look like in Hollywood, too.
Yes, I do.
And specs. You're famous for your specs.
Yeah.
So if you're going to be specky, be the specky guy.
All right.
So you were 8 years old.
I was 8 years old.
The
thing about specs is they're a total shield for me. I wear dark specs now on stage. I'm working toward Roy Orbisonhood, where I don't see the audience at all.
Then you'll be fully in the moment.
Absolutely.
Beyond Buddy Holly, beyond Elvis Costello, Roy.
There's a hip club in L.A. called Largo, and I wear my dark glasses in there, and it's a dark nightclub, and I can't see anyone. So I'm completely offending people at all times because they go, hey, Greg, and I'm like, who are you? And then one time on stage...
May I feel your face?
Yeah, I said, the reason why I wear the dark glasses is because I don't want to see y'all. I'm sick of your judgment, quite frankly. I need to be in my own bubble up here.
See, isn't radio great?
Oh, it's fantastic.
You don't see anything.
No. I just feel like the ghosts of Lenny Bruce and Bill Hicks are spinning madly right now in a huge vortex.
Yeah,
thanks for channeling us in such an ineffective way, Greg.
Well, there's always another night.
Yeah.
And we hear him. We hear him in there. And we're glad that you're out there kicking Greg Proops. We will continue our conversation with Greg Proops after a short break. Let's go into it, listening to him with the British version of Whose Line members performing in a game called Sound Effects. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
As we go into a game called Sound Effects for Ryan and Greg, they get to act out a scene, very straightforward, but they have to incorporate some sound effects to be played in as we go along. The scene I like to do is lifeguards on the beach. Away you go.
I don't know. I can't turn. My neck is too muscular.
What neck?
Hey, you look great, Bill.
You sure look good.
A lot of chicks out there today. I hope someone...
Ooh. Get a load of the Indian girl.
Hey, I think she likes you.
I think so, too.
Here, I'll turn on the radio and see if we've got any emergency calls. Wow, I love that modern jazz.
Me, too. Yo. I've been thinking of leaving the lifeguard business.
Really?
Yeah, it's just not challenging enough for me anymore. I mean, what do we say? One, two people here a week?
Sure. What are you going to do?
I don't know. I thought I'd start a new line of occupation. Maybe become an organ donor.
Sure.
I hear there's good money in it.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to you on your new job.
Thanks, Bert.
What's
that? You hear something? My God, there's somebody drowning and choking on something at the same time.
No, there's... Sounds like they're sucking on a cat of some kind.
All right, I'll save him, Bill.
Red alert. Red alert.
I got a submarine!
Hold up!
Yeah! The crew seems to be happy about it.
Support Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Greg Proops, a stand-up comic by profession who's appeared on the hit TV show Whose Line Is It Anyway, both in America and Britain. Here's Greg Proops on his experience in Australia.
Always looking for that place, you know, where there's no rednecks, that place where people get along, and I never find it. I went to Australia, right? And I thought Australia was going to be a groovy, surfnoid, smoke-a-joint wombat, you know. G'day, mate. No worries, you know. And it's like Arkansas with a beach. It's a whole country with a no fat chick sticker on it. You know what I'm saying? Short on the top, long in the back. Sets off my gold chain. And Australians, they hate English people, but that's genetic memory. They hate Americans. And they, which blew my mind. They blame us for stuff that I didn't know we were on the hook for. I had an Australian guy tell me, listen, mate, we didn't have crime till America. You didn't have crime?
Greg Proops on Australia. We've got him on just about, well, a little bit of everything tonight on the state of the nation and where we're headed. Greg, we haven't talked at all about sex, and of course that's required in every show with a comedian, but this is NPR. So you've said that you find intellect sexy, that a clever woman on stage, you know, doing her thing, being clever, laying it out there is just as good as it gets. What women are funny these days?
These days? Well, Ellen DeGeneres is always funny. Paula Poundstone is remarkably funny. Janine Garofalo, Margaret Cho, they're very funny. In England, I'd actually said that about Jennifer Saunders and Dawn French, who had their own comedy team there. And Jennifer Saunders, of course, created Absolutely Fabulous, which is, I think, one of the funniest sitcoms of all time, if not the funniest sitcom of all time.
Now, do you love Ellen DeGeneres for her humor or her courage?
Both, both. I admire her courage. I just did a documentary about her for Radio 4. And she is, of course, immensely courageous as a person. She is, as a stand-up, not the kind that we've been talking about all day. She doesn't break. Now she does a little more. Mm-hmm. Before she came out, she was just clean and bright, basically, and real observational. Mm-hmm. But she's a master of that. She's a technician like Seinfeld or Newhart. Actually, Newhart's more subversive. I won't lump him in there. Mm. I think Newhart is a highly subversive comedian.
Give us a sense of the edge of subversion you see on Newhart.
He kicks against the corporate world. If you listen to his record routines from Button Down Mind and all of the subsequent ones, it's always the little man versus the machine. All of those phone calls mm-hmm. are about people either
making.
Yeah, so he has a sense of because he was an accountant, because he did work in the corporate world. I said as much to him when I interviewed him, and he of course was delighted to agree. His favorite comic's Richard Pryor, Bob Newhart,
which is not Pryor.
Yeah, it's not a jump that you would make. And he said he met Pryor once at a tribute, and Pryor came up to him and said, I used to steal your album because I didn't have the money to buy it. And Newhart went, well, I used to get a quarter for each album, and Pryor gave him a quarter.
There you go. But for all that admiration and for the sex appeal of intellect, one of your projects oncoming, you tell us, Pamela Anderson, Stripperella on TNN, soon to be Spike TV, maybe. You're voicing over something here.
Yes, I'm one of the mad scientists with Tom Kenny, who's a fellow comedian, and he is
now, Stripperella also... Stripperella is a television cartoon,
yeah,
is that
Stripperella
right?
is a superhero. She's a stripper by night and a superhero by day. This is very empowering for the women of America, by the way, and I want you to know how much I dig you chicks. This is a Pam Anderson project. I was called in to do a voice on it. Tom Kenny and I are the mad scientists. Tom is the voice of SquarePants SpongeBob. So if you have children, you are overwhelmed with SquarePants SpongeBob, and you know who I'm talking about.
Yes, I'm afraid I do.
So he and I are the mad scientists on the show. As I say, I'm not above prostitution of a certain form. I was compensated to be a voice on the show. I did meet Pamela Anderson, who is extremely diminutive, by the way. She's a Hummel figure. She's a Christmas ornament.
She's sort of 4 feet, you name it.
She's
I don't know.
Ridiculously small, like Judy Garland small, and with enormously funny sort of animated proportions.
Yes, and she dresses animated up, in a sense.
There you are. Some of them are animate objects and some of them are inanimate objects that are attached to her body. She dresses that way in the daytime, so it's fairly wild.
It's right around the clock with Pamela.
Well, like, I'm not used to women wearing belly chains around me, and she wears a belly chain to go to work.
You've gone after Ozzy Osbourne. What's your problem with Ozzy?
I love Ozzy Osbourne. What I said was that he met the president, and that it proves that if you spend a lifetime abusing class say substances and you speak like a third grader, you can make it big in this country. And Ozzy's done well, too. And I think the Osbourne show has been really healthy for America because they are the dysfunctional family that represents us all. In the end, they love each other. They don't hate each other. They're much closer than I am with my family. And I don't know about they're in each other's pocket.
Yes, they are.
I mean,
it's very intimate, isn't it?
When you were 18, did you really want to spend that much time with your dad and your mom? I mean, it's crazy.
Other side of the world. But your family, Proop Dog, Greg Monkey, are these family intimacies? We read them in your stuff here. Or is that just part of your warm and fuzzy web presence?
It is, actually. A lot of the fans have bestowed those on me. Proop Dog is something the other comics called me in San Francisco, and Proop Monkey is too. And my fans are called Ocelots. Ocelot kittens.
You went from San Francisco to L.A. What's that migration like?
Well, I went via London for 5 years, so it was the best kind of migration. I didn't dive right into the shallow end. I spent some time on the bitter end and then went back to the shallow
end. Did that prepare you well for L.A.? What, toughen you up, harden your shell?
A little bit. I think L.A. and London have a lot in common in that everything's a secret and that hierarchy is strictly enforced in a medieval Japanese shogun sense. Everyone compares New York to London, but they're not alike at all.
We're scared now. And everyone you've said, you're posing success every minute.
Oh, yes, of course.
Everyone must in L.A. because that's
I would never show up like I am here. I'm unshaven because we're on the radio today.
Yeah.
In L.A., I'd have my hair combed and I'd be bronzed and I'd bleach my teeth and I'd have my car washed and I'd have a suit.
Greg Proops, that is exactly the way we see you in our mind's eye, and we thank you for raising the image. But we love you just the way you are right here. We're so grateful to you for coming, and it's been just great having you. Thanks so much.
You're very kind. Thank you so much. I hope it was as entertaining as Gene Simmons on the Fresh Air Show, because you aren't ready for what's in my pants, Tom.
Well, but there's a whole lot of things to aspire to right there in one sentence. Greg Proops, thank you for joining us. Listeners, for more information on Greg Proops and when he'll be coming to your town, visit our website at onpointradio.org. This is On Point.
I went up to Drew's house because he's getting married. He's going to be married to the girl that'll be Mrs. Drew Carey. He said there'd be a stripper, and there wasn't. It was scary, because when the stripper came out, it was Drew Carey. At a bachelor party, we took off our clothes. It was pretty wild. Heaven knows, I was embarrassed when I went to tip her. Turned out my mother was the stripper. My friends threw me a party. I knew that I was sunk. We stripped right down all night long, got really drunk. Dancing with my naked friends, boy, that's the life. As a matter of fact, to hell with my wife.
Antonín Dvořák is perhaps the most famous classical composer of Czech descent. Many of his best-known pieces were written after a visit to the United States in the late 19th century, when he began to weave African and Native American musical themes into his symphonies. Audio archaeologist Ned Connors digs up sounds and stories from the past for On Point. Tonight he brings us the story of an African-American musician from Erie, Pennsylvania, and the indelible mark he left on Dvorak during the great Czech composer's stay in the United States.
The celebrated Czech composer Antonín Dvorak arrived in New York City in 1892 to direct the National Conservatory of Music, an innovative school unusual in that it welcomed deserving female, African, and Native American students. Dvorak, who grew up in Bohemia, had no previous contact with blacks. In a famous and controversial letter to the New York Herald in September of 1893, he said this of the plantation songs introduced to him by his black students at the conservatory. Negro melodies are the real foundation of any serious and original school of composition to be developed in the United States. In these melodies, I discover all that is needed for a great and noble school of music. His Symphony from the New World, grafting purely American influences onto a European classical form, premiered the same year to great acclaim and considerable debate. One of Dvorak's African-American students, Harry Burley, played a profound role in introducing spirituals to the Bohemian composer. Born in 1866, Burley listened to and learned the sorrow songs sung by his maternal grandfather, a former slave. His mother, despite a college education and fluency in French and Greek, worked as a domestic in the household of Mrs. Elizabeth Russell, who held recitals in her home. Young Harry was allowed to answer the door and listen to the performances. Burley had some musical training in Erie. At age 26, with $30 in his pocket and a letter of recommendation from Mrs. Russell, he auditioned for a seat at the conservatory and received a scholarship to begin his studies the same year that Dvorak arrived at the school. A gifted baritone and pianist, Burley became Dvorak's personal assistant and friend. And during those years in New York, he introduced the spiritual to his bohemian mentor.
I got a harp, you got a harp, and all I got to got a harp. When you get a hymn, gonna play on the harp, gonna play all over the hymn, hymn, hymn. Can't buy a song about him, ain't going to him, him, gonna play all over the hymn.
As Burley described them, spirituals weren't composed, but sprang into life, ready-made from the white heat of religious fervor, the simple, ecstatic utterance of wholly untutored minds. In this 1916 recording of Heaven, Heaven, the Tuskegee Institute singers evoked the primitive, centuries-old vocal traditions of West Africa. Dvorak was captivated by the melodies and harmonies of the spirituals he learned from Burley, and he encouraged him to transcribe and arrange them for publication. It took a while, but in 1917, Burley published a collection of 48 Negro spirituals arranged in the tradition of the European art song for solo voice and piano. Here's a young Marian Anderson performing Burley's arrangement of Deep River in 1924. Of musical tradition, William Arms Fisher, another student at the National Conservatory, composed what some called a pseudo-spiritual based on the Largo from Dvorak's New World Symphony. He called it Going Home. Here's Paul Robeson live at Carnegie Hall in 1958. Dvorak's belief that African influences would have a profound, defining effect on the future of American music was remarkably prescient. But it didn't happen in classical music as he imagined. In 1917, the same year that Burley published his art song arrangements of Negro spirituals, the Victor Studios in Camden, New Jersey, recorded a little-known New Orleans band then playing an engagement at a Manhattan restaurant, the original Dixieland Jazz Band. African-American influences would come to define American music, but this influence would come from the wellsprings of jazz, blues, and rock and roll. They all have their roots in the plantation songs of sorrow and hope, so beloved of Dvorak and Burley.
I'm going home, the Lord, I'm going home, I'm going home, the Lord, I'm going home.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Brother, come home, the Lord.
brother, come home. Lord, Lord, brother, come home.
I'm going home.
Oh, yes.
I'm going home.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks.